We're going to be discussing Choshen Mishpat, Jewish civil law. Just a few brief words of introduction about the discipline. Choshen Mishpat, Jewish civil law, is the halacha, the Torah's system of regulations of what we call ben adam l'chavero, intercourse between people. Pretty much parallels modern civil law. We have a fairly, as we'll see, we have a fairly rich and long-standing tradition of what these rules are, and it can stand up without any, you know, it can make a very good case against any other system of law. Just in general, I'll begin by giving at least my view of Choshen Mishpat. It is pretty laissez-faire. Property rights are a pretty sacred, pretty bedrock value in Choshen Mishpat. Freedom of contract is a pretty bedrock right in Choshen Mishpat. Halacha typically recognizes property rights as being very, very fundamental and not quite inalienable, but a pretty strong and pretty, it's a pretty high bar to cross to take away someone's property rights. Similarly, people have nearly unfettered freedom of contract, in many ways more so than under modern law. We don't really have public policy objections to contracts. You can pretty much contract whatever you want. The rule is kol tnai shav mamon kayem. That means that two parties who go into a contract knowing what they're getting into can pretty much make up whatever they want. Again, halacha doesn't articulate an economic philosophy, an economic attitude per se, but in practice, halacha is a very laissez-faire system. Again, as you said, freedom of property, freedom of contract. There is no such thing as, natively at least, there's no such thing as discrimination law. There are no price controls built into halacha. You can pretty much sell for whatever you want. You can price your goods or services whatever you want. You can, the seller can ask whatever he wants. The purchaser can offer whatever he wants. The worker can ask whatever he wants. The employer can offer him whatever he wants. Pretty much anything goes. People sometimes mention the category of ona'a. There is a prohibition against undercharging and overcharging, deviating from market prices. But a careful reading of the literature indicates that it's a complex and difficult topic, but that is much more akin to a system of regulations against fraud. Sophisticated parties who know the prevailing prices and choose to contract at a different price are perfectly free to do so. Nothing will generally stop them as long as both parties are clearly aware, they're sufficiently sophisticated to understand. We don't really have any statutes against gouging in general. Even as we'll discuss soon, even collusion is not something which there's antitrust, collusion, restraint of trade. These aren't concepts that have any direct analog in halacha. We'll discuss soon. Many of these things do find their way into practical halacha, into on-the-ground Jewish civil law, because halacha does grant communities, the Beit Din, the court, or the local governing authority, national governing authority, we are granted the right to legislate, and just as under American law, even if the basic common law, or basic federal law, or basic constitutional law doesn't have any of these restrictions, governments are free to legislate within reason, within constitutional bounds, and to pass laws, and that's what we'll be discussing a little bit later today, how the different authorities viewed some of these laws. But the starting point, native halacha, it is a pretty laissez-faire system with property rights being at the bedrock of all of it. Now, there are some thinkers, some theorists of Jewish law who like to argue that there is a fundamental difference between Jewish law and other legal systems. They argue that a typical modern Western legal system is about rights, everything is based on rights, while they argue that halacha, Jewish law, is more focused on duties. I personally do not think that this is a useful or correct distinction. I think that a straightforward understanding of Choshen Mishpat, particularly of Jewish civil law, indicates that it can be most clearly and directly understood largely as being about rights also. Almost all of halacha that relates to interpersonal relationships really can be most straightforwardly and simply conceived of as which rights halacha grants to various parties, individuals, communities, the public as a whole, sellers, buyers, workers, employers, classes, individuals. But in general, I think the simplest model for understanding most of halacha is very much a rights-based model, much like other legal systems, and I think in this particular area, the distinctions can be exaggerated. One interesting distinction which we do find, at least according to some thinkers who I respect greatly, even though I've said that Judaism, that we do have a very strong system of property rights, there are certain exceptions. I recently read an interview with Professor Nachum Rockover, one of my heroes from Israel. He's a major figure in the Mishpat HaIvri movement. Mishpat HaIvri is a movement to kind of reconceptualize rewrite Choshen Mishpat, Jewish civil law, from the perspective of modern legal categories, some comparative law. Rockover is very, very good. He's a past master of the subject, very familiar with, expert in halacha, very well-versed in secular law. He was asked in an interview how he would define the difference between halacha and other Western legal systems. He argued that the notion of tzedek, of yosher, of righteousness, is something that is the warp and woof of halacha in ways that it is not in other legal systems. He said, even though in English and common law systems we have equity as a corrective to the law, equity is something which is apart from the law, it's a corrective added from outside to the law. And halacha, and the same Shulchan Aruch, the same major codes of Jewish law that tell you what everyone's rights are, also have this additional layer of equity which is incorporated seamlessly into the halacha itself. He gives an interesting example. He says there was the following case that came before a bet din, or a rabbinical court in Israel. There was a man who ordered a refrigerator. Turned out there was no way to take delivery. It wouldn't fit through the front door of the building. The obvious way to get it in was through a porch. Now, this man did not have a suitable porch, but his neighbor did. It was an apartment building or a condominium of some sort. His neighbor had a porch where the refrigerator could have been brought in. So they asked the neighbor, would you mind? He said, yes, I would mind. Unless you make suitable compensation to me, I do not grant you the right to use my premises. So the case came to a Beit Din. The Beit Din obligated the neighbor to let him use the apartment without compensation, or perhaps with de minimis compensation. I think the implication was without any compensation. So Rockover says, when he mentioned this to an American attorney, the lawyer laughed and said, a man's home is his castle. What kind of business? My property. Why on earth would a court award anybody else the right to use someone else's property without his permission? But halacha does, Rockover says, the Beis Din says, and that is an example of a fundamental difference where property, that's actually in this week's parsha, we read about Sodom. Next week's parsha, the Midas Dom is a halacha category, meaning, at least under this interpretation, that sometimes the court will force somebody to decline to exercise a property right where he has no meaningful objection. He just wants to stick it to someone else or just wants to extort money from him, but he has no reason to care. They can argue, you can quibble. In that case, there might be reasons he would care. It's inconvenient. He's worried the workers will break his paintings. Some people feel they have to spend 3 hours cleaning their house or dressing up before workmen come in. So you can argue in the details, but in principle, the idea of Midas Dom, Rockover holds it up as a classic example of how halacha actually is different from secular systems. In this particular case, I've spoken about this recently, there actually is considerable debate about whether this is true. There are many opinions in halacha which reject this and say, no, absolutely not. It might be nice to do so, but the court cannot compel someone to give up rights to his property and that the person's property rights are inviolable. But in general, this is the point. Halacha is, it's fair to say, it can be conceived of as a rights-based system. Property rights and freedom of contract are fairly fundamental. And in general, the position we start from is very much one of laissez-faire. That now what we'll discuss today, there are some exceptions to this. It's not a purely ideologically, absolutely pure laissez-faire system. There are many cases in the Talmud and in later authorities where we find exceptions, where halacha does have a more interventionist, a less purely capitalist system. We'll be discussing a number of these examples today and discussing the philosophies, the economic philosophies, the social philosophies that go along with these perspectives. Now, in general, as I said, halacha, both classically as well as even in later sources, don't usually articulate overtly modern theories of economics, and it is always particularly entertaining when they do. One classic instance where this occurs, beginning about 1920 or so, after World War I, we have extensive literature in the 20th century on rent control, rent stabilization legislation. I grew up in New York, where this is very common, and it's abused. Also, we have rich congressmen who have four rent controls of the apartments. But the halakhic discussion of this begins, not necessarily his fault, it's the fault of the system, whatever. I'm not trying to assign fault, but the point is the halakhic debate about the halakhic attitude, approach toward such legislation begins about 1920, after the enormous depletion of housing stock due to the ravages of World War I. So European governments began passing such legislation, and the poskim had to grapple with the question of what should halacha's attitude be, assuming we have two Jews. Again, if one of the parties is not Jewish and is not listening to halacha, then the question is moot. But assuming both parties are Jewish and they want to follow Torah law, the Torah's ideals on this, so what does the Torah think about such legislation. And it falls into two parts, really two categories. There is legislation that prevents you from evicting tenants, and then there's legislation that holds the rent down, well, artificially low, well below market prices. There are some differences between them. We're not going to discuss the whole topic, but just in general, one striking treatment to the topic by the Chavetz Chaim Sharon, Rabbi Babad, about 1920, he was very skeptical, very suspicious of such legislation. Maybe, he said, some of his rabbinic opponents felt it was okay. The immediate aftermath of World War I, where things were desperate and housing was not to be found anywhere, maybe in a special case, limited duration, we could tolerate such legislation. Not in general, he says. And he winds up, he says, particularly, he says, because such legislation is generally the product of the new members of parliament, he says, ha-socialistin, va-communistin, whose entire worldview is to redistribute wealth from the rich to the poor, an attitude which is hepach midas tarasenu, which is diametrically opposed to the opinion of the Torah. He takes what we would consider a very Republican kind of, very conservative, very libertarian view, and he did not think that almost overtly modern philosophy of economics terms did not feel that such legislation in general is legitimate. Rav Henkin, however, a leading American authority, Yosef Elio Henkin, writing about 50 years ago in America, New York, he takes almost exactly the opposite approach. He says the government is doing its job. That's the duty of government, to help the poor against the untrammeled excesses of the rich. That's the job of government, to protect the poor. Even if the laws are tilted to the poor, they give more protections for tenants and more protections for certain types of apartments than others. That's exactly what the law is supposed to do, he says, and it's nachon and yashar and correct and upright. And Poskim, again, have taken very different attitudes. Sometimes the positions they take, as I've mentioned, will reflect almost an explicit economic philosophy. Sometimes they don't. We have another tshuva reflecting a very libertarian sensibility. One of the standards halacha utilizes when determining what attitude to take toward a given law is the standard we apply, is the law l'tovas b'nei hamedina? Is it for the good of the populace? Obviously a very broad and very loose and very not well-defined standard, but it's a very, but sometimes we work with standards like that that are just very general and very very sweeping. So Poskim have to discuss, halachic authorities debate whether legislation like rent control legislation is considered truly for the benefit of the community. So we have a tshuva in the Marshak, Rabbi Shimon Greenfeld, also a mid-20th century European authority. He says, what do you mean, he says, you're going to tell me that the legislation is for the benefit of society? Well, which class of society, he says? There's one class called the landowners, the landlords, one class called tenants, he says. Yes, such legislation is very good for the class of tenants. Not so great, he says, for the class of landowners. From their perspective, he says, you're simply, again, depriving them of their property, of their freedom of contract, the right to dispose of their property, to rent it out, to make contracts about it as they see fit. That's not their good, he says. You're simply privileging one class, one economic or social class, against another one. That's not legitimate, he says. Halacha has no business. We have no business meddling in the economy, so to speak. Kind of a very libertarian class warfare, a little bit, a very, very libertarian attitude. We have no business saying that legislation is good when it happens to benefit one class at the expense of another class. From their perspective, we are depriving them of their right to enjoy their property as they see fit, and therefore we take a skeptical view toward that kind of legislation. Now, turning to some of the sources I have on these handouts, a lot of the discussion we'll be referencing today has to do with competition, business competition, professional competition, economic competition. Now, again, the starting point in halacha is, there is a Talmudic debate about this, which I don't have here, but the starting point is, normative halacha, according to virtually all opinions, is that free competition is the rule. Vendors have the right to open up competing businesses. Professionals have the right to offer competing services to incumbent professionals. In general, there is a differing opinion in the Talmud, but the norm of halacha follows the rule that businesses can do whatever they want, and they are free to buy, sell, trade, offer services, whatever they want, and there are very few restrictions. Now, there is a Mishnah, passage in the Mishnah and the Talmud, in the end of Bava Metzia, very brief, very terse, very little discussion in the classic sources, but a great deal of discussion in later sources. I have that in section one here, Hebrew and the English translation. There are two disputes in the Mishnah itself between Rabbi Yehuda, a specific Tana, and the general opinion. Rabbi Yehuda was strict. He prohibited two types of economic promotion, so to speak. One of them is basically what we would call promotions, giving out treats or little candies to the children. The children would be sent by their parents to purchase groceries or whatnot for the parents. Storekeepers would try, the children would have a choice to choose which store to go to. Storekeepers would try to attract their custom to them by offering these little promotions. Rabbi Yehuda says you may not do that. It's considered an unfair competitive maneuver against the other stores. The other sages say no, that is fine. The Talmud explains why, because that's a neutral tactic open to all players in this industry. I can give out one kind of candy. Again, you'll see the words are nuts and plums. You know, today we would call it candy. Back then, these were considered treats for the children, different types of roasted agricultural products and fruits. And my baby, first child, we were still able to give him dates and grapes, and that's his idea of sweets and treats. He hasn't really been exposed to cupcakes, pizza, ice cream, and gumdrops yet. But so that's one dispute between Rabbi Yehuda and the sages. The other dispute has to do with price cutting, an even more prevalent question. How much flexibility do vendors have to initiate price wars, to try to undercut their competitors? Again, Rabbi Yehuda says you may not do that. Rabbi Yehuda says you cannot do that. And the sages say that you can. The normative halacha in both cases follows the permissive view. We follow the ruling of the Chachamim. You are allowed to offer promotions such as these. You are allowed to lower prices. You're allowed to engage in these types of behavior. Now, you would think, based on the Talmudic passage, that really should pretty much answer the question. That the norm of halacha, you would think, should be that, in general, laissez-faire still carries the day. You're allowed to engage in any type of business maneuver that you want. However, the serious discussion of this point really emerges in the 18th and primarily the 19th centuries. We have a number of differing views in the later sages, the later halakhic authorities, mostly European 19th century scholars. And perhaps surprisingly, many authorities took a much stricter view. Many authorities did not feel that free competition was legitimate, that they did not feel that this type of price cutting was okay. Many of them operated on the assumption that stability is a key value, that we want the market to remain stable. We don't like this type of disruption and creative destruction and all that. We want the livelihoods of sellers to be protected. And what about the Talmudic passage? They had a number of different explanations. Some of them have argued that the Talmudic passage, if you read it very carefully, the Talmud says, why do we permit lowering prices? Or the translation is not actually so accurate. Many authorities say the translation should read, the rabbis of the Mishnah said, Zocher Latov, someone who cuts prices, his memory shall be for a blessing. We highly approve. So the Talmud says, why? Because it uses a very obscure expression. It says, Marvach Tara. It causes a general looseness and relaxation of the tightness of market conditions. Some authorities just take that at face value. They say, in general, any price cutting is okay. But the aforementioned school of stringent authorities, they say, Marvach Tara is a special dispensation in special cases. We're dealing with hoarders or upstream people in the distribution channel. The wholesalers are not releasing enough product, and somehow by starting a price war on the downstream, on the closer to the customer, that will somehow cause the wholesalers to release more product. It was a special halacha related to special economic conditions in those cases. But in general, there are authorities who say that we have considerable concern for the stability of the livelihoods of the sellers, of the producers, and we are not willing to simply allow freewheeling, completely cutthroat competition. Halacha will step in to prevent merchants from just selling at whatever price they want, as this could be destructive for the livelihood of the sellers. Now, this is not really a settled matter. You will find authorities on both sides of the issue. It seems to me that the more compelling or the more popular position is the one that is more or less laissez-faire, the one that seems to me the more straightforward reading is the one that would allow free competition. Certainly in modern conditions in the United States, there would be even more cases for that. That's the custom, that's the law. And in general, I think that would be the more standard opinion. But at least in the 19th century, at least under the economic terms that held then, there were many authorities who felt that we should take a more stringent view and not allow completely unfettered competition. A related debate occurs. I mentioned earlier that in general, competition is a right that anyone has. Any merchant has the right, any service provider has the right to open up a competing operation to an incumbent. There is one exception, the Talmud says, and this is accepted, that if the incumbent is a local resident and he has a business or offers a service locally, people who are not local residents, they're in a different country, different city, want to come in and offer their goods or services without becoming local residents, the locals will have the right to object. Now, what this means in practice is very difficult. What's considered local as opposed to foreign today, city, state, nation, treaties, and all that. There's a lot of discussion about what this means in practice. We're not going to get into all the details. Suffice it to say that this halacha is not often applicable. There are those who will say that if it's a real out-of-town or it's coming to sell, that it can be prohibited, but they didn't. Rabbinic courts will often debate the matter. It is a halacha with some relevance, but it's of limited significance in most situations of competition, especially because many authorities rule that even if the owner of the business is not local, if his employees will be local, then he's bringing benefit to local citizens. That's also okay. Most businesses will have at least some local footprint, even if the owners and the ultimate masters are not local. So the application of this halacha is complicated, but in principle, at least, we do have this rule that an outsider will sometimes be restricted from competing against the local business people. Now, we have a very interesting dispute between two early medieval Spanish authorities, Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash and the Ramban, Nachmanides. Rabbi Yosef ibn Migash argues, the Rimigash, he argues that the entire restriction that the rabbis placed, even in these specific circumstances, against competition, against outsiders competing, against certain other cases of competition, even where the rabbis did institute some restriction on competition, that was only insofar as there is no benefit or no significant benefit, we'll discuss that question soon, to the local consuming public. If it doesn't really matter to them, it's just a question of the incumbent versus the newcomer, then the rabbis instituted certain limited restrictions. However, he says, if they are offering better prices, or better services, or better product, or better in some material way, then the rabbis instituted no such restrictions because the rabbis had no interest at all in protecting the rights of the producers at the expense of the interests of the public. It was only if the public doesn't really matter, then they protected incumbents against newcomers, but not at the expense of the general public. The Ramban, Nachmanides, disagrees. He makes a kind of reductio ad absurdum. He says, what's the first thing you learn in free market economics? Competition is always good for the consumer. The more competitors you have, the more players in an industry, almost by definition, it's a strong default assumption, it'll almost always be better for the consumer. And yet we find the rabbis still instituted certain prohibitions. So clearly, at least in some cases, the rabbis felt that it was worth protecting the rights of incumbent producers, incumbent sellers, incumbent professionals against newcomers, even at the expense of some inconvenience to some economic lack of benefit for the public. Now, there are those who kind of try to split the difference. There are some later authorities who try to argue that we can distinguish between, again, using very ill-defined general terms, but we can distinguish between large or great benefit for the consumer versus moderate or nominal benefit for the consumers. Some want to compromise and say that there's always going to be some benefit, but if it's only minor benefit, then we should respect the rights of the incumbent producers. If there's going to be major benefit, we have to defer to the interest of the public. So basically, you can find three opinions in the halakhic authorities. Some say any benefit for the consumer is a reason to override any protections of the producers. Some say no benefit for the consumers is enough to override the protection of the livelihood of the incumbent producers. And some say it depends whether it's a major versus minor benefit. Halacha, again, is not entirely clear, but the general principle of resolving these types of disputes in this area of halacha is that the court will not restrict someone who wants to sell if he has significant opinions on his side. So in general, we'd be inclined to be lenient that, and this is a common thing that comes up in Dine Torah, in cases being decided based on rabbinic law, the newcomer will almost always try to argue that he is providing some benefit and preferably some material benefit for the public, and that is a reason why the court should not interdict him from opening the store. And then the court has to decide whether the facts are indeed true, whether obviously it's a projection. We don't have a crystal ball, but we always try. We can get experts, we can get forecasters, we can always try to figure out will there be some benefit for, significant benefit for the public? Now, the Ramban, in his treatment of the topic, makes a very, very interesting and very incisive comment. The Ramban feels that we do have to protect the producers even at the expense of the public. However, he is sensitive to the need to protect the public interest, true. He doesn't simply want to dismiss that as being irrelevant. Clearly, Halacha does recognize that the public's needs need to be protected. So what do we do about that? So the Ramban says he has a solution. If the community is worried that by the Halacha granting an artificial monopoly to the incumbent producer, that will result in prices being higher than they should, they have two options, he says. They can either foment more local competition. They can either try to egg on, instigate some locals to open a competing business, and that's perfectly okay. Or, he says, what they can do, we mentioned earlier, Halacha grants a very robust right to government on various levels, including local, municipal, communal level government, to regulate trade, to regulate the local economy. Ramban argues that they have the right, and perhaps even the duty, to regulate the prices of the incumbent monopolist. They basically treat him as a regulated monopoly. On the one hand, he has the right to say that we shouldn't introduce competition because it hurts him too much. On the other hand, the community can say, okay, but we're going to regulate your prices and you will not be able to charge whatever the market will bear. Now, in basic economics terms, I'm no economist, but what I learned in very, very old-fashioned economics 101, we have supply curves and we have demand curves, and in a quote-unquote theoretical free market, the equilibrium price will be wherever those curves intersect. When the prices go high, supply tend to go up because they can produce more at a higher price. When prices go up, demand goes down. And when those two curves intersect, that will be where the theoretical textbook-style economic price will settle out. A monopolist will move over on the curve because he can charge higher than the equilibrium price. He'll still be making more of a profit. That's considered economically inefficient because people will be, there'll be unsatisfied demand. The public is losing out because there'll be more demand and less stuff being produced. Producer doesn't care because he's able to charge a high enough profit for him to make it, he'll make more money by selling at a higher price than selling fewer units at a higher price than he would by selling at the equilibrium price. That is the classic economic problem of monopoly. So the Ramban says, great, the solution to that is regulation. Even though we know, even if we accept that from a free market perspective, regulation to set artificial price ceilings and floors is a bad idea, because if you regulate the price to a point which is different from the free market equilibrium, you'll either have unsatisfied demand, you'll have lines, you'll have gas lines or food lines or whatever, or you'll have problems like that. But in this case, the Ramban is really arguing, at least he doesn't spell this all out, but what I think he means from an economic perspective is that regulation will simply, regulation properly done, well, easier said than done, obviously, but regulation properly implemented will simply bring the inefficient monopoly price that the local protected incumbent is trying to charge, he'll bring it back in line with what should be the equilibrium price. So the obvious question on that is, so then why would the halacha take away with one hand and deny the right to competition, allow him to become a monopolist, and then add a corrective for the local community to simply regulate him back down to equilibrium? Why not remove the hand of government, simply allow the incumbents to come, allow actual competition to set prices without all the intervention by government? I don't know. The Ramban, I think it's fair to say, was probably not thinking in quite the same terms, probably not making quite the same assumptions as modern or mid-20th century textbook economics are. My understanding is also modern textbook economics, there's kind of a wide recognition, need to be spruced up a little bit. They work in textbooks, but the real world is more complicated, and there are all behavioral economics and all kinds of other complexities where the real world doesn't always follow the simple textbook rules. But in any way, taking the broader view, the point we see is the halacha is clearly sensitive to both the needs to protect the livelihoods of the producers as well as the needs of the community, of the consuming public, to get fair prices, affordable prices. Where exactly to draw the balance is going to be the subject of different opinions. We have the Rimigash, who takes a more laissez-faire approach, that free competition should always be the order of the day. The Ramban, who takes a more protectionist approach, he says that halacha does grant incumbent protection even at the expense of consumers, but B, he kind of balances it out by a second interventionist idea by pointing out that the community has the right to regulate the market to try to bring that back into what the Rimigash would probably hope that the free market would accomplish on its own. Now, on the subject of collusion, I reproduced here an excerpt of an article from the Jerusalem Post about 8 years ago. This involves allegations, actually. I don't know if it ever went to trial or what actually happened here, but it involves accusations of collusion among manufacturers of certain types of clothing. You can read the article for the details. This was very much a Jewish thing, clothing popular in the Jewish market. The stores felt that there were a niche market to begin with. Their profit, they were struggling to keep a viable business going. So dozens of stores got together and colluded to coordinate their markups, coordinate their sales. They shouldn't go on sale too early. They shouldn't mark things down beyond certain points. And obviously they ran into trouble. They quickly ran into trouble, or not so quickly, I don't know how long it took, but they ran into trouble with the modern Western American law. You can't do that. That's a conspiracy and restraint of trade. There are problems with that. Price fixing, per se, unlawful. You know, not a lawyer. I don't know the details, but I know enough to know that that is a serious issue. The question is, halakhically, what is the issue of collusion? We've been discussing before whether halakha will step in and actually grant protection to some economic actors. Here we're dealing with the reverse question. If they themselves want to collude, they're not asking for the law's help. They're willing to collude on their own. Airlines, clothing manufacturers, you name it. I actually, when I was preparing my notes for this, I ran into a case of matzah collusion some years ago. Manischewitz, Horowitz, Margaretten, Streitz. Bunch of the big name matzah producers were apparently found guilty of some kind of illegal collusion and slapped with a 7-figure fine. But so the question is here: what is the native position of halacha itself? We're not getting into the question of what a Jew has to do with regard to respecting the law. We're discussing putting aside the law. If we'd be in a society where there was no law, where the law was more or less laissez-faire and didn't prohibit collusion. Real Victorian laissez-faire economics before they introduced Sherman and all that stuff. What would the halacha say about agreements and restraint of trade by players in an economic market? When I was involved in the Beit Din previously, not here in Greater Washington, we once had a case. Someone approached us. He wanted us to issue a summons to Beit Din arbitration. That his case was as follows. He and a competitor of his had entered into some sort of gentleman's agreement to collude and keep prices high in their industry. He felt that he had suspicions or proof that his partner in crime, so to speak, was not living up to their agreement, and he wanted the Beis Din to enforce this agreement. So our secretary turned to us and said, "Do we want to take this case?" So I said, "Sure, halacha has an opinion on it one way or another. We'll take into account the law. We'll take into account native halacha. That's our job." And he's like, "We don't really want to be discussing whether we should enforce agreements in violation, possibly in violation of federal law." It turned out I think the case didn't come to us. They either dropped it or settled it or something. I don't know what happened. I don't remember the details. But for our purposes, speaking academically, what is the halachic attitude toward collusion? So the Post is a little thin on rigorous halachic sources. The one thing they mention, again, quoting Professor Rockover, the one thing they mentioned toward the end of section 2, and I have the Hebrew quote of Rockover's article in number 3, Rockover quotes a ruling and interpretation of Rabbi Menachem Meiri, a leading early 14th century Provençal scholar. He argues that even though there is Talmudic basis for the idea of guilds, for the idea of regulation within an industry by players in an industry, by the vendors, by the sellers, by certain types of professionals, they do have the right to regulate the prices and the terms on which their goods will be offered or their services will be offered. The Meiri says they cannot do that. They cannot make price controls without the imprimatur either of the communal leadership of some sort, rabbinic leadership, communal leadership, because for this very reason, even though the Talmud does grant them the rights, the local professional organization, the local guild, the local union, to somehow regulate and control their own industry, not when there's a clear conflict of interest with the interest of the consuming public. In such cases, the Torah does not grant them this right. Now, I'm not sure if the Meiri means as much as he sometimes quoted as saying. Meiri is simply saying that they're not granted by halacha enforceable governmental power to pass such regulations on their membership. He does not say that a private contract or covenant they enter into will be voided by halacha necessarily, but in any event, the Meiri again does clearly indicate the same principle that everything has to be a balance between the interests of the the interest of the consumer and the interest of the sellers, of the providers, and where exactly to draw the balance is going to depend on different opinions. Again, halacha doesn't have that much to say about collusion. There is no general sweeping prohibition of collusion, short of this Me'iri, which they bring, he and Dr. Varhaftig, another noted Mishpat Ivri scholar, they bring this Me'iri, but you know, Me'iri is a fairly peripheral source, and there's nothing like a main front and center statute of halacha that prohibits collusion. Again, we're not discussing the question of deference to secular law, but in principle, native halacha, it is far from clear that agreements to collude are actually problematic. A third area where this comes up is the concept of buying Jewish. Halacha does have a strong preference for Jews to buy Jewish where possible. It's related to tzedakah, the idea that Jews should support Jews wherever possible, just like in the United States, buy America is a value many people have. So buying Jewish is a value the Torah has that ideally a Jewish consumer should try where possible to give his custom to Jewish vendors and vice versa. Jewish vendors should try to give the business to Jewish customers where possible. And there is tremendous dispute, however, whether this applies even where this means, let's say in the case of the customer who's trying to buy, who has two vendors who sell the product he needs, a Jewish one and a non-Jewish one, does this apply even where the Jewish one is more affordable, where the Jewish one is less affordable, where the non-Jewish one will be cheaper? Major dispute among the rabbinic authorities. This actually goes back to a celebrated 16th century rabbinic cause celebre involving the very early printing dispute. There was a leading rabbi at the time, Rav Meir Katzenelnbogen, the Maram of Padua, Rav Meir of Padua, an Italian rabbi. He was producing an early edition of the Rambam, Maimonides' Codes of Jewish Law, and he entered into partnership with a Christian printer. Most of the printers then were Christians, an Italian printer, they issued an edition of the Rambam, major work of Jewish law. This non-Jewish printer had a business rival, personal rival, business rival, who really hated him, was out to get him, and he decided to kneecap his rival by producing a rival Rambam, a competitive Rambam, and he would dump it on the market, even below cost, I think. He had deep enough pockets to do it, just to destroy the economic viability of his rival. Predatory competition for vindictive and malicious motives. So the Rav Meir of Padua turned to his cousin, Rav Moshe Isserles, the Rama, another one of the leading halachic authorities of the time, to get him to issue an interdiction that all Jewish consumers should not buy this vindictive Rambam, they should only buy the Rav Meir of Padua's Rambam. And the Rama did. The Rama did issue an injunction against any Jewish consumer buying this Rambam for a number of reasons. The first one has to do with the idea of undercutting we discussed earlier. We mentioned earlier there's a lot of murkiness about whether completely freewheeling price competition is the name of the game, but the Rama says that's only within a normal business model, when it's destructive, when you're trying to drive somebody out of business, when it's vindictive, when your pricing model is not stable, it's not economically viable, particularly when your pricing model is for the entire purpose and will likely have the effect of driving someone completely out of business, and that's your whole goal. And certainly, if that's the outcome, the Rama prohibits that sort of competition. This is a very controversial ruling. Later authorities have argued hammer and tongs about it, down to contemporary rabbinic courts. We'll go both ways on this, but that was the first of the various reasons given by the Rama, Moshe Isserles. Another reason he gives is the idea of buying Jewish. He says Jews really have a duty, where possible, where economically feasible, to buy Jewish, and therefore supporting Rav Meir of Padua and his venture is a major value. Even though his Rambam is more expensive, Jews still have an obligation to buy his, even though it's more expensive. And again, this is also a very controversial point. Halachic authorities down through the generations have debated it. Many of them have said it's not fair. We can't expect the consumer to take a major, certainly not a major loss. Again, here we have three opinions. Some say you should always buy Jewish, even if there is significant expense in doing so. Some say you're never strictly obligated to buy Jewish if there's even a relatively minor price differential. Some say we differentiate between major price differential, minor price differential, with again major and minor not being defined entirely rigorously. Some use up percentages. Some say it's just an economic judgment based on what your economic status is. But in any event, buying Jewish too, we have the same idea. On the one hand, you have a duty to protect and support Jewish businesses. On the other hand, many authorities say we will not do that at the expense of the finances of the consuming public, and many authorities try to find, try to split the difference and find some suitable middle ground. Just close with one last responsum, because it's a favorite of mine, kind of illustrates these themes. This is a tshuva in Rabbi Aaron Taubes, 19th century Romanian authority. There was a kosher lePesach form of liquor made out of whatever they make kosher for Passover liquor out of, non-grain, obviously. And there were Jewish stakeholders who had large stockpiles of this stuff. A new process was developed. They developed a liquor called Tuzhemak, Tuzhemsky rum, inland rum. It was produced from some byproduct, the syrup of sugar beets, instead of real rum from sugar from the Indies. So this was produced by non-Jewish factories, and it was much cheaper than the old stuff. So the stakeholders in the old system who had stockpiles of the older stuff, was more expensive. They asked for an injunction that no Jews should buy the new stuff, even if it was kosher. They should only buy their stuff, because they stood to suffer economic loss, certainly loss of revenue, maybe even actual loss of out of pocket if people would buy the new stuff. He was disinclined to grant the injunction, assuming the kashrus issues were taken care of. He said, first of all, he rules that Jews cannot generally be obligated to buy a more expensive product, even if that means that the Jewish producers will suffer. But his third argument is a particular favorite of mine. He says, he makes the following equation. He says, cheaper liquor means more liquor. More liquor on Passover is more holiday cheer, more Simchas Yom Tov. He says, that's an important halachic value, and we should not stick up for the interest of the producers if the alternative will result in more Simchas Yom Tov, more holiday cheer for the Jewish community.